next session, number 29702,
reel 3. The storm is defense fire, and we had some success with it. But the problem were very soon the escort fighter. We had to protect this heavy loaded Focke-Wulfs and 19s by our own fighters, and even when the rockets were fired, with or without success, the Jews were presenting a lot of resistance. So we had a device to let them fly away, to spring with a load, with an explosive, yes, like an action seat. We also tested in Focke-Wulf this 21 centimeter going backwards. So the Focke-Wulf were overflying or underflying the formation and going on top and fired this rocket backwards. We had also tests with the rockets of the size of 15 centimeters, 150 millimeters. We had rocket bombs in the 410 of 250 kilos. We tried to drop bombs from altitude to this formation. Big bombs with proximity fuses and small bombs, a lot of small bombs. We had cables which we towed against the four engine bombers. We had cables with explosives in it. Tried this. We had a battery of 20 millimeter rockets installed in Focke-Wulf. We had 5 centimeter short range rockets in the Messerschmitt 163. And finally, by the end of the war, we got the 50 millimeter rocket, which could be fired in Sals. This was the most successful thing. I personally had in the last days success in firing one Sals of 12 and another Sals of 12, and I shot down 2 Marauders, because one impact of this rocket would kill the 4 engine. So all these attempts had a certain success, but the success was eliminated by the American fighters, especially by the B-51s later on.
Thank you, General.
Roger, please, may I?
Yes, of course, Cass.
I can't let General Gallen get away with those disparaging remarks about the B-38 as a fighting machine. I would remind him that it has a pretty good record in the European theater.
Ah, these partisan people. We're coming to the P-38, and this is something which we've got to go over very carefully. But that will be in the next session when the long-range fighters really get going. What I'd like to do is to go back to the bomber men in what time we have left before questions. But Philip Ardrey has a request.
I'd like to comment on what the General just said, which pleased me very much that he agrees with me that when they had the choice, they always enjoyed choosing the B-24s, but one point at which I disagree with him very much. He said that they were spread about and they were in Norway and everywhere. I had counted them in Norway and in Western Europe. And in the first time I ever saw the Luftwaffe was in Crete, I think. But I disagree with him in that he said that there were never enough. I always thought they had plenty.
I must say that I thought I could depend on General Gallen to be impartial, but there's a wicked twinkle in his eye. This B-17 and B-24 business, perhaps he doesn't realize that you think that the guys who flew B-17s and the guys who flew B-24s were on opposing sides. But perhaps it was that way with the men in the Luftwaffe who flew 190s and 109s. But going back to the bomberman, I would like to ask the two members of our panel who flew B-24s and B-17s, with all the increase in the summer of 1943 Luftwaffe attacks on the unescorted bombers, is it true that Purple Heart Corner was the most dangerous place in a bomber formation? If not, which was the most dangerous slot to fly? And what was the most dangerous place if you were a B-17 or B-24 crewman to fly? Where were you most likely to get killed or wounded during a fighter attack? I think we'll start with the B-17 men first, and then we'll give the B-24 gentlemen, the last say. We've got to do something for the B-24. It's just had a pretty rough ride. General Houston.
Remember, I belonged to a later era in 44. I think it was a function of a variety of things that General Gallen just talked about. I think the tightness of the formation. I think what other tempting targets there were. I think all these variables entered into it. As he said already, a straggler was not a very safe place to be. I'm not sure Purple Heart Corner, Roger, back to General Audrey's comment, if you could hit out, if you could hit the lead or the deputy lead, you certainly did tremendous damage to that formation, I think, psychologically, also to that formation. So I think there were too many variables in there. In the navigator's compartment, I cursed, as all you did, how I got to be so large and why I couldn't fit under that damn desk. I also liked the fact that that escape hatch, although number two propeller was too close for comfort, but that escape hatch in the front, I think, was a very nice place. I don't think I can get up into it now, but I think that from the navigator's standpoint, I think that was a very good place to be. I think you had forward vision that other people didn't, sometimes permitting you then a chance to see what was headed your way. I think you always felt a sense of frustration in terms of the ability to fire back. Even the chin turn to operate by the bombardier, I think, was more psychological for him, something to hang on to in all of this than rather anything with any great efficacy. I'm not sure I answered it, Roger, but let's see what General Ivory said.
I would incline to agree with you, General. I think that the head-on attacks were the ones that initially were most likely to be made. Now, after an attack like that, if the German fighters had flown through the formation and had knocked out a couple of aircraft or knocked out a couple of engines and made stragglers, the stragglers would usually be attacked and perhaps knocked down thereafter. But I was more fearful of an attack on the lead and deputy lead, which would demolish the effect of the formation. So we're in agreement on that point. Now, I think I would also agree that I couldn't see much difference in the various places in the bomber. All of us were pretty much terrified when we looked out and saw the General's Abbeville kids floating through our formations, and I remember it being said on many occasions, and a lot of you guys will remember it too, that people say, and they wore these steel helmets, that they crawled up into the steel helmets so far you couldn't see anything but a pair of feet sticking out.
Lovely. You notice the subtlety in selection here, going back to this B-17 and B-24 business. We have two major generals, you see. It would never have done to have somebody of lesser or higher rank. You get what I mean? We've got a nice balance. I nearly brought my steel helmet. Ladies and gentlemen, although we've only really allowed a quarter of an hour for questions, I would like at this point to get some idea of the number of people who would like to ask a question or put a quick point of view in this session. Would you raise your hands? Well, from the number that have been raised, I think we might go straight towards the questions now. What I would like you to do is to just give your name, ask your question, and try and be brief. If you want to make a point of view, I'm sure the panelists are happy to hear, but please, please be brief, because there's a lot of other people who want to say something. So, can we have the first one? You, sir.
Jack Shock, thank you for the phone. My question is directed to General Gallagher. General, can you tell us about German fighter plane production from 1942 until the end of the war?
Sir, I'd rather you kept it to the early period at this point, because it's going to get a bit confusing as we're going to deal with the latter part of the conflict in the second session. But I'll leave it to General to decide how he's going to answer that one.
You know that the German Air Force had just 5 years to be built up. And in these 5 years, doubtless, the strongest air force of the world has been built, but without any reserve, without any reserve in aircraft and in pilots and in crews, mechanics and so on. And when the war started, Hitler had just given an order to triplicate the air force, what was impossible for many reasons, for lack of labor, for raw material, and for other reasons. The Air Force would have needed the time to consolidate first. But when the war started, we had a production, I think, of less than 350 aircraft per month. And this production were concentrated on the fighters, 350 fighters, of the 109 and 110 type. Then from 42 on, the Focke-Wulf 190 was built in addition, and very soon has proved as a better and superior aircraft to attack the bomber formation, based on higher firepower and based on the protection the pilot had behind this very big engine, air-cooled engine. The production of fighters has been increased and has reached its highest point in 44, when more than 4,700 aircraft has been built, fighter aircraft.
Can I just interrupt the questions, because something very important has happened. We have been honored by somebody who represents the proud, proud organization which you fellows belong to, the current commander of the 8th Air Force, Lieutenant General Robert Harris. Welcome, sir. Very pleased to have you here. And this comes from a limey. But I can tell you that the guys that you look after today will be hard put to keep up with this lot. Anyway, let us go back to the questions. We'll have somebody from this side. You, sir.
General, back in November 1942, both of us referred to Abbey all those boys, they were named a different group. And at that time, research that I've done, all I see is to refer to Paul Wolf 190. I remember seeing both, but were you aware that we were bragging up or fearing mostly these people we call here in the Circus National and the all those boys? In the English author, Wolf Wesley, he says this is a myth. Is this true, or were you aware of it?
Yes, thank you very much. This other little boy did belong to my wing. And they were guided, commanded at this time by my younger brother, which was killed after 54 victories. And between these 14, four engine bombers. So this, his group, consisting of three squadrons, were based in Abbeville, and this what you were calling the Abbeville boys. But the other squadrons, which were in the other two groups, they were equal brave. This was really one of our best wings we had. Also in the Battle of Britain, forgive me, when I was the wing commander, 26th Wing was known as the best escort wing. So, no wonder that you mentioned the Abbeville boys and the Yellow Noses and the fighters at this time. And also did you give respect to the Focke Wulf 190. Even so, we had technical difficulties in the beginning with the engine. But the aircraft itself, especially against bombers, was superior to the 109 by far.
It is a fact that any German fighter with a yellow nose was known as one of the Abbeville so-and-sos, whether it was seen over France or as far away as Kiel. So that shows their fame. Next question, sir. You at the back. Name, please. Hi.
I'd like to address my question to General Gunnell. We started operations in July 1943, and we had a good deal of experience with the Abbeville kids. I was wondering if you or Colonel Filler was in charge of that particular area.
And we may have exchanged tracers, and I'm glad we're both here.
We did like the Marauders even more than the B-24s. we called them the Halbstarken. The Halbstark is a boy which is not a man, it's not a youngster. Something like this. So we looked out if we could find in the twin engine Marauder formation, and this was, we were quite happy.
I have to add, though, that the B-26 had the lowest loss rate of any bomber type in Europe. So, anyway, thank you, General. We'll have the gentleman right at the back there. Your name, sir?
Colonel Boley, 389th Bomber. I have an article here taken from the Air Force magazine that says that 18,190 B-24s were built and 12,692 B-17s. That means that for every two B-17s built, there were three B-24s built. And I was going to say that probably reason is that it was a triple threat bomber. It bombed them, strafed them, and then fell them.
Was neither a question or a comment. It was a declaration of war. It's you, sir.
Marky Hovsepian, 466 Bomb Group. I'd like to address the General Gallen. Was the experience that was gained from the Spanish Civil War of any value to the Luftwaffe in World War II?
Absolutely, yes. When we developed in Spain the four-finger tactic for fighters, and when we encountered the Royal Air Force, first in Belgium, they were flying in very close formation. Only one man was able to overlook the air. It was the leader, the squadron leader. All others had to watch out to keep their position in the formation. And fortunately enough, the Royal Air Force kept this tactics during the first weeks of the Battle of Britain and changed by then to our tactic. So far as attacks against bombers are concerned, Spain didn't bring very much. Spain brought technical knowledge and tactical advantages for the German Luftwaffe and also for the German anti-aircraft, there's no doubt.
So, can we have another question? I better go back this side, gentlemen, as I've had two from that side. Can I have the man in the front row? Your name, sir?
Can you repeat
the question, sir? There is a microphone there if you have difficulty.
My question to General Gallant is this. I would like to know to what extent the German fighter pilot was trained on instruments and to what degree the aircraft contained instruments. The reason for my question is, on many of my missions, I saw solid cloud cover over the continent, no fighters, but I just wondered if they could come up through and also then be retrieved by ground control.
The answer is that the normal German fighter pilot, day fighter pilot, was not trained to fly by instruments. Not because we didn't have the need, but we didn't have the time, we didn't have the instructors, we didn't have the aircraft, we were short on everything. So the normal day fighter pilot was not trained to fly by instruments. He was able to penetrate the clouds and go up and come down. And we tried to do this in formation, close formation. But we had some special wings, which were called bad weather wings. Those pilots were trained to fly by instruments. The equipment in the aircraft was poor. We had an horizon, and we had a homing, and we had a radio, that's all. Of course, the night fighters, and also the twin-engine fighters, they were trained from the beginning to fly by instruments. Completely.
Another question. You, sir, in...
My name is Chip Childs.
Can you shout, sir?
My name is Chip Childs, former naval officer, Vietnam and 9 aviation historian. My question is directed at General Gallant. In late 43, early 44, when the 8th Air Force was steadily building up the bomber formation, the size of the bomber formation, still unescorted, but the Luftwaffe was also building up, and the loss rate on the 8th Air Force was steadily mounting. Did the German fighter command think, that they might perhaps be breaking the back of the 8th Air Force, that maybe daylight rates would start to fall off or diminish?
No. I wonder if you could come to the microphone. I think what the gentleman asked was... I think what the gentleman asked was whether the Luftwaffe believed during the summer of 1943, when it was obvious that they were knocking down an awful lot of 8th Air Force bombers, that they were actually winning, that they were actually breaking the back of the bomber offensive. Is that right?
Yes, sir, that was the question.
But you can repeat it if you'd like.
Well, you basically said that. I was just curious. Did the Germans at any one time think that the end was that if we continue in the 8th Air Force, it's going to have to stop bombing the Reich, or they're going to slow down?
I can tell you that we had the opinion we could finish with the daily operations by certain means, but this belongs, so far as I understood, to the second part of this meeting. If you like, I can also mention this right now.
No, General, I think he means during the summer of 1943 and the autumn of 43, when the bombers were still going out alone, the Luftwaffe was certainly destroying large numbers of B-17s in particular, and the loss rate increased to something like 14% on some missions. Did the Luftwaffe believe that it was at last stopping the American bomber raids, or beginning to stop them, by the heavy losses that it was causing at that time?
Not at this time. The great numbers of shut down aircraft and the Schweinfurt raid and the Regensburg raid, they were lucky situations when we were able to attack them when the escort has left. And in this occasion also our twin engine fighters were very successful. But later on in 44, we found out that we had other chances to stop the offensive. But I will leave this answer to the second part.
Thank you. Roger, I think it should be mentioned that after Second Schweinfurt, that there began to be some doubts, and the correspondence exists on the American side. In terms of, A, the domestic arena back in the United States, and note there was a change in command in the 8th Air Force in December of 1943, which I think represented some of these doubts. Regardless of the Luftwaffe's thinking, I think that there was some question in the United States and in and among the Army Air Force's community. To say nothing, obviously, the Navy was never convinced that this was the way to go. If it didn't displace so many tons, it wasn't worthwhile. But in any event, I think this is true of any success. We were eventually successful, but I don't think we've studied this period of grave doubt, I think that's the right phrase, in about September, October, November of 43. It began to turn around in December of 43, but I think there's some grave doubts in that three-month period. Thank you. Question there, sir.
My name's Tom Garrett. I was in the 98 Bomb Group of the 12th Air Force in Africa. I'd like to direct a question to General Gallen. Was the Luftwaffe ever aware of Mr. Norden before he left Germany and came to the United States to develop the Norden bomb sight, which was one of our prime in the whole war? Comment on that?
We were not aware, at least I am not aware. Even so, I represented the United Aircraft, which is a Norden company, Norden division, after the war. The bomb sight must have been very effective. Therefore, one word in comparison of the effects of the day raids and the night bombing. From the military point of view, the day raids with the exact bombing of important targets was much more effective than the night bombing of towns. Barna Harris has believed that the moral can be broken. That's not the case. The German moral has not been broken like the English moral could not be broken by bombing London.